Memorial services are underway as we speak for Senator John McCain at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Meghan McCain spoke urgently and passionately about the legacy of her father. We're joined by Ron Elving. He's NPR senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
And NPR's Kelsey Snell is outside of the cathedral. Kelsey, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Henry Kissinger is speaking at the moment. We've also heard from Senator Joe Lieberman. Let me ask you both about the remarks made by Meghan McCain. Deeply personal eulogy, deeply personal memories of her father and reaction, but also some very pointed things to say with political smack, if I might put it that way. Ron and Kelsey, let me just quote one. She said, "We gather here to mourn the passing of American greatness, the real thing, not cheap rhetoric from men who will never come near the sacrifice he," meaning her father, "gave so willingly." What's the impact of that?
Well, without saying President Trump's name directly, she criticized him very clearly. She made first reference to her father's service in Vietnam and compared it to people who lived in, quote, comfort and privilege while he suffered and served. Trump famously avoided the draft in Vietnam, where McCain was a prisoner of war. Then she made reference to Trump by using his own slogan.
"The America of John McCain is generous and welcoming and bold. She is resourceful and confident and secure. She meets her responsibilities. She speaks quietly because she is strong. America does not boast because she has no need to. The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again because America was always great."
You know, and I think it's very notable here that she has been very emotionally raw throughout this entire memorial process over the past week. And she stood on the lectern and was very, very forceful and very direct about this. And it happened as Ivanka Trump, the daughter of President Trump, was sitting in the room.
Yes, and I must say Ivanka Trump and Jared Trump were not, at least to my knowledge, expected to attend. They did attend, from what I could see on the monitors here. They were graciously received by everybody around there. It's as if this has become such an event in the life of America, they felt they needed to be there.
You know, it's interesting that the family, the McCain family in general, had made it clear they did not want President Trump to attend this event. They didn't want him to come to Arizona for the earlier event there. And yet, in some of these arrangements and in the pointed decision not to have him here, you raise the issue of that rivalry, of that bad blood between the senator and the president, and that very deep philosophical difference over so many things. And that, too, hovers over this event, even though the president himself is absent.
And, of course, we must note he also had philosophical differences and political differences with Barack Obama, who ran against him for president, and George W. Bush, who ran against him in the Republican primaries. And they will be speakers at the memorial service today. So it's
their choice to be speakers in this service is a part of McCain wanting to distinguish the fact that while he did have policy differences with Presidents Bush and Obama, they went on to have very close personal relationships, and they shared mutual respect and honor between them. And that has been one of the major themes of all of these memorial services, is that McCain wants to make clear that he had close relationships with people with whom he disagreed.
Ron, how is this memorial service at the National Cathedral different from what we saw previously in Arizona?
This is much more of an international affair. This is much more of a symbolic affair. This is John McCain making his bid for American history, for his place in American history, for his place in the pantheon of important political figures. That's why the last three presidents are sitting in the front row. That's why we're expecting to hear from Obama and Bush. And they are going to enshrine John McCain in a way that probably nothing that would happen back in anyone's home state could do.
Kelsey and Ron, what can you tell us about the attendance that we see? An extraordinary collection of signature Americans, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that we've really been noting here is how bipartisan the crowd is here. Basically, every major power player in the city of Washington and in the federal government is inside of the cathedral right now. You also have plenty of people who ran for president. We have Bob Dole is in there, as we've mentioned, former presidents Bush and Obama, but also former President Clinton is there, and all of the leaders of Congress are inside. It is
Hillary Rodham Clinton, of course.
Yes, she is also there. It is a this is basically anybody who has been involved in political life in America in the entirety of McCain's political career is here.
Including Warren Beatty, a well-known liberal Democrat and contributor, but is apparently a close friend of Senator John McCain. We will note that Dr. Henry Kissinger has just concluded his remarks. He's shaking hands with the Obama family and the Bush family and is making his way back to his seat. Just shook hands with General Kelly, of course, the Chief of Staff. Ron and Kelsey, I believe there's going to be some, there's going to be the Battle Hymn of the Republic will be sung. What can you, how do we summarize the remarks of Senator Joe Lieberman, who was quite moving and pointed and funny?
Go ahead, Ron.
I was just going to say that, Joe Lieberman and John McCain struck up an unlikely friendship in the Senate, and Lieberman commented on that himself. He commented on the fact that John McCain talked seriously to him about being his running mate, even though they did not share a political party. And that that is a remarkable way to remember John McCain at this particular moment, and a pointed issue that's being made again and again in this funeral and in the commentary this past week, is how much we miss John McCain's truly heartfelt spirit of bipartisanship and how many friends he genuinely had across the aisle.
Yeah, and we can't say enough that these all were people that were specifically chosen by McCain before his death. This was very closely orchestrated to send a message to the American public about what kind of leadership McCain saw for, out of his own personal career, and what kind of leadership he'd like to see going forward.
Some of the personal insights in Senator Lieberman's remarks, too. By the way, it's the U.S. Naval Academy Glee Club is now singing Amazing Grace. Where he talked about the fact that Senator McCain sort of accommodated himself to Senator Lieberman's Orthodox Judaism. And he said how fitting that John's memorial service should be on the Saturday, because he knows that means I had to walk here to the National Cathedral. But
Because Joe Lieberman is Orthodox,
yes,
and doesn't use public transportation or any form of transportation, any motorized transportation, on a Saturday morning.
And I was very struck by just the personal recollection where he said that after he left the Senate, Senator McCain kept encouraging him to get an apartment in Jerusalem, where the two of them, a city they visited a lot together and grew to love, could sit out on the balcony and look over the that often troubled city that they both revered, and just be with each other and with a sense of history. It was a very moving moment, at least for me.
You know, that's an unrealistic expectation in terms of not only the logistics and the cost and the health of the two people involved, but it's still an authentic sentiment on part of John McCain. That would be something he would much like to do. He was a great student of history. He lived a great deal of history. We just saw Henry Kissinger recalling some of that history. And of course, Henry Kissinger was National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State during the Vietnam, during the period that John McCain was in the Hanoi Hilton.
Yeah. It, in many ways, isn't it, Ron and Kelsey, a funeral that befits someone who has been a chief of state, and suggests that John McCain, although he never became president, fulfilled a very special role in the life of the United States.
Well, choosing this location, I think, imparted some of that ceremony to it all. This is a place, after all, that has been the site of places where that they have prayer services after inaugurations, and where presidents like Reagan were memorialized at before a national audience. So the location has a strong significance, and just the number of people who are here really puts McCain at a level of national prominence that isn't shared by many.
And Kelsey, there are people outside too. I gather the crowd on Wisconsin Avenue is considerable.
Oh, it is. And one of the most interesting things that we're seeing here is that people are gathered around the satellite trucks that are feeding the video from inside of the cathedral, and they're crowded around the trucks to watch those feeds so that they could be here and be in this space and still watching it. It's pretty remarkable.
We are awaiting, and now former President George W. Bush is making his way to the podium, and we will be hearing from former President Bush, George W. Bush, in just a moment.
To be with you to offer my sympathies and to celebrate a great life. The nation joins your extraordinary family in grief and gratitude for John McCain. Some lives are so vivid, it's difficult to imagine them ended. Some voices are so vibrant and distinctive, it's hard to think of them stilled. A man who seldom rested is laid to rest, and his absence is tangible, like the silence after a mighty roar. The thing about John's life was the amazing sweep of it, from a tiny prison cell in Vietnam to the floor of the United States Senate, from troublemaking plebe to presidential candidate. Wherever John passed throughout the world, people immediately knew there was a leader in their midst. In one epic life was written the courage and greatness of our country. For John and me, there was a personal journey, our hard-fought political history. Back in the day, he could frustrate me. And I know he'd say the same thing about me. But he also made me better. In recent years, we sometimes talk of that intense period like football players remembering a big game. In the process, rivalry melted away. In the end, I got to enjoy one of life's great gifts, the friendship of John McCain, and I'll miss him. Moments before my last debate ever with Senator John Kerry in Phoenix, I was trying to gather some thoughts in the holding room. I felt a presence, opened my eyes, and 6 inches from my face was McCain, who yelled, "Relax, relax." John was above all a man with a code. He lived by a set of public virtues that brought strength and purpose to his life and to his country. He was courageous, with a courage that frightened his captors and inspired his countrymen. He was honest, no matter whom it offended. Presidents were not spared. He was honorable, always recognizing that his opponents were still patriots and human beings. He loved freedom with the passion of a man who knew its absence. He respected the dignity inherent in every life, a dignity that does not stop at borders and cannot be erased by dictators. Perhaps above all, John detested the abuse of power, could not abide bigots and swaggering despots. There was something deep inside him that made him stand up for the little guy, to speak for forgotten people in forgotten places. One friend from his Naval Academy days recalls how John, while a lowly plebe, reacted to seeing an upperclassman verbally abuse a steward. Against all tradition, he told the jerk to pick on someone his own size. It was a familiar refrain during 6 decades of service. Where does such strength and conviction come from? Perhaps from a family where honor was in the atmosphere, or from the firsthand experience of cruelty, which left physical reminders that lasted his whole life, or from some deep well of moral principle. Whatever the cause, it was this combination of courage and decency that defined John's calling and so closely paralleled the calling of his country. It's this combination of courage and decency that makes the American military something new in history. and unrivaled power for good. It's this combination of courage and decency that set America on a journey into the world to liberate death camps, to stand guard against extremism, and to work for the true peace that comes only with freedom. John felt these commitments in his bones. It is a tribute to his moral compass that dissidents and prisoners in so many places, from Russia to North Korea to China, knew that he was on their side. And I think their respect meant more to him than any medals and honors life could bring. The passion for fairness and justice extended to our own military. When a private was poorly equipped or a seaman was overworked in terrible conditions, John enjoyed nothing more than dressing down an admiral or a general. He remained the troublesome plebe to the end. Those in political power were not exempt. At various points throughout his long career, John confronted policies and practices that he believed were unworthy of his country. To the face of those in authority, John McCain would insist, "We are better than this. America is better than this." John, as he was the first to tell you, was not a perfect man, but he dedicated his life to national ideals that are as perfect as men and women have yet conceived. He was motivated by a vision of America carried ever forward, ever upward, on the strength of its principles. He saw our country not only as a physical place or power, but as the carrier of enduring human aspirations, as an advocate for the oppressed, as a defender of the peace, as a promise, unwavering, undimmed, unequal. The strength of a democracy is renewed by reaffirming the principles on which it was founded. And America somehow has always found leaders who were up to that task, particularly at the time of greatest need. John was born to meet that kind of challenge, to defend and demonstrate the defining ideals of our nation. If we're ever tempted to forget who we are, to grow weary of our cause, John's voice will always come as a whisper over our shoulder. We are better than this. America is better than this. John was a restless soul. He really didn't glory in success or wallow in failure, because he was always on to the next thing. Friends said he can't stay in the same experience. One of his books ended with the words, "And I moved on." John has moved on. He would probably not want us to dwell on it, but we are better for his presence among us. The world is smaller for his departure, and we will remember him as he was, unwavering, undimmed, unequal.
Former President George W. Bush has just completed his remarks about Senator John McCain at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. He's being escorted back to his seat. We expect to hear from former President Obama momentarily. President Bush is greeting Cindy McCain, shaking hands with President Obama. President Obama has picked up his remarks, and he's now being escorted to the podium, and we will hear now from somebody who also ran against John McCain for president, but spared no admiration for him.
Mrs. McCain, to Cindy and the McCain children, President Mrs. Bush, President Secretary Clinton, Vice President Mrs. Biden, Vice President Ms. Cheney, Vice President Gore, and as John would say, my friends. We come to celebrate an extraordinary man, a warrior, a statesman, a patriot, who embodied so much that is best in America. President Bush and I are among the fortunate few who competed against John at the highest levels of politics. He made us better presidents, just as he made the Senate better, just as he made this country better. So for someone like John to ask you, while he's still alive, to stand and speak of him when he's gone is a precious and singular honor. Now, when John called me with that request earlier this year, I'll admit sadness and also a certain surprise. But after our conversation ended, I realized how well it captured some of John's essential qualities. To start with, John liked being unpredictable, even a little contrarian. He had no interest in conforming to some prepackaged version of what a senator should be, and he didn't want a memorial that was going to be prepackaged either. It also showed John's disdain for self-pity. He had been to hell and back, and yet somehow never lost his energy or his optimism or his zest for life. So cancer did not scare him, and he would maintain that buoyant spirit to the very end, too stubborn to sit still, opinionated as ever, fiercely devoted to his friends, and most of all to his family. It showed his irreverence, his sense of humor, a little bit of a mischievous streak. After all, what better way to get a last laugh than to make George and I say nice things about him to a national audience? And most of all, it showed a largeness of spirit, an ability to see past differences in search of common ground. And in fact, on the surface, John and I could not have been more different. We're of different generations. I came from a broken home and never knew my father. John was the scion of one of America's most distinguished military families. I have a reputation for keeping cool. John, not so much. We were standard bearers of different American political traditions, and throughout my presidency, John never hesitated to tell me when he thought I was screwing up, which by his calculation was about once a day. But for all our differences, for all the times we sparred, I never tried to hide, and I think John came to understand the long-standing admiration that I had for him. By his own account, John was a rebellious young man. In his case, that's understandable. What faster way to distinguish yourself when you're the son and grandson of admirals than to mutiny? Eventually, though, he concluded that the only way to really make his mark on the world is to commit to something bigger than yourself. And for John, that meant answering the highest of callings, serving his country in a time of war. Others this week and this morning have spoken to the depths of his torment and the depths of his courage there in the cells of Hanoi, when day after day, year after year, that youthful iron was tempered into steel. And it brings to mind something that Hemingway wrote in the book that Megan referred to, his favorite book. Today is only one day in all the days that will ever be. But what will happen in all the other days that ever come can depend on what you do today. In captivity, John learned, in ways that few of us ever will, the meaning of those words. How each moment, each day, each choice is a test. And John McCain passed that test again and again and again. And that's why when John spoke of virtues like service and duty, it didn't ring hollow. They weren't just words to him. It was a truth that he had lived and for which he was prepared to die. And it forced even the most cynical to consider, what were we doing for our country? What might we risk everything for? You know, much has been said this week about what a maverick John was. Now, in fact, John was a pretty conservative guy. Trust me, I was on the receiving end of some of those votes. But he did understand that some principles transcend politics. That some values transcend party. He considered it part of his duty to uphold those principles and uphold those values. John cared about the institutions of self-government, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, rule of law, separation of powers, even the arcane rules and procedures of the Senate. He knew that in a nation as big and boisterous and diverse as ours, those institutions, those rules, those norms are what bind us together. They give shape and order to our common life. Even when we disagree, especially when we disagree. John believed in honest argument and hearing other views. He understood that if we get in the habit of bending the truth to suit political expediency or party orthodoxy, our democracy will not work. That's why he was willing to buck his own party at times, occasionally work across the aisle on campaign finance reform and immigration reform. That's why he championed a free and independent press as vital to our democratic debate. And the fact that it earned him some good coverage didn't hurt either. John understood, as JFK understood, as Ronald Reagan understood, that part of what makes our country great is that our membership is based not on our bloodline, not on what we look like, what our last names are. It's not based on where our parents or grandparents came from or how recently they arrived, but on adherence to a common creed that all of us are created equal, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. It's been mentioned today, and we've seen footage this week of John pushing back against supporters who challenged my patriotism during the 2008 campaign. I was grateful, but I wasn't surprised. As Joe Lieberman said, it was John's instinct. I never saw John treat anyone differently because of their race or religion or gender. And I'm certain that in those moments that have been referred to during the campaign, he saw himself as defending America's character, not just mine. For he considered it the imperative of every citizen who loves this country to treat all people fairly. And finally, while John and I disagreed on all kinds of foreign policy issues, we stood together on America's role as the one indispensable nation, believing that with great power and great blessings comes great responsibility. That burden is borne most heavily by our men and women in uniform. Service members like Doug and Jimmy and Jack, who followed their father's footsteps, as well as the families who serve alongside our troops. But John understood that our security and our influence was won not just by our military might, not just by our wealth, not just by our ability to bend others to our will, but from our capacity to inspire others with our adherence to a set of universal values like rule of law and human rights and an insistence on the God-given dignity of every human being. And of course, John was the first to tell us that he was not perfect. Like all of us who go into public service, he did have an ego. Like all of us, there were no doubt some votes he cast, some compromises he struck, some decisions he made that he wished he could have back. It's no secret, it's been mentioned, that he had a temper. And when it flared up, it was a force of nature, a wonder to behold. His jaw grinding, his face reddening, his eyes boring a hole right through you. Not that I ever experienced it firsthand, mind you. But to know John was to know that as quick as his passions might flare, he was just as quick to forgive and ask for forgiveness. He knew more than most his own flaws and his blind spots. And he knew how to laugh at himself. And that self-awareness made him all the more compelling. You know, we didn't advertise it, but every so often over the course of my presidency, John would come over to the White House and we'd just sit and talk in the Oval Office, just the two of us. We'd talk about policy and we'd talk about family and we'd talk about the state of our politics. And our disagreements didn't go away during these private conversations. Those were real and they were often deep. But we enjoyed the time we shared away from the bright lights. And we laughed with each other. And we learned from each other. And we never doubted the other man's sincerity or the other man's patriotism. Or that when all was said and done, we were on the same team. We never doubted we were on the same team. For all of our differences, we shared a fidelity to the ideals for which generations of Americans have marched and fought and sacrificed and given their lives. We considered our political battles a privilege, an opportunity to serve as stewards of those ideals here at home and to do our best to advance them around the world. We saw this country as a place where anything is possible, and citizenship as an obligation to ensure it forever remains that way. And more than once during his career, John drew comparisons to Teddy Roosevelt. And I'm sure it's been noted that Roosevelt's Man in the Arena oration seems tailored to John. Most of you know it. Roosevelt speaks of those who strive, who dare to do great things, who sometimes win and sometimes come up short, but always relish a good fight. A contrast to those cold, timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. Isn't that the spirit we celebrate this week? That striving to be better, to do better, to be worthy of the great inheritance that our founders bestowed. So much of our politics, our public life, our public discourse can seem small and mean and petty. Trafficking and bombast and insult and phony controversies and manufactured outrage. It's a politics that pretends to be brave and tough, but in fact is born of fear. John called on us to be bigger than that. He called on us to be better than that. Today is only one day in all the days that will ever be. But what will happen in all the other days that will ever come can depend on what you do today. What better way to honor John McCain's life of service than, as best we can, follow his example? To prove that the willingness to get in the arena and fight for this country is not reserved for the few, it is open to all of us. That in fact it's demanded of all of us as citizens of this great republic. That's perhaps how we honor him best. By recognizing that there are some things bigger than party or ambition or money or fame or power, that there's some things that are worth risking everything for. Principles that are eternal. Truths that are abiding. At his best, John showed us what that means. For that, we are all deeply in his debt. May God bless John McCain. May God bless this country he served so well.
Former President Barack Obama speaking, of course, at the memorial service at the National Cathedral for Senator John McCain. He was preceded by former President George Bush. And President Obama joked. They had both run against Senator McCain had run against both men for president, and he said, "What wonderful revenge. John would have enjoyed this, forcing both George and I to say good things about him to a national audience." We're joined by NPR's Ron Elving and NPR's Kelsey Snell, who was at the cathedral. Thanks both very much for being with us. Ron, what stood out for you in the remarks of these two former presidents, one Republican, one Democratic?
It did not seem as though they had been forced to say nice things about him. It seemed more as though they were eager to say the kinds of things about him that came from the deepest part of their affection, not just for John McCain, but for the country, for politics, for the way our politics have worked, for the way our history has been formed. The speeches taken together were tremendously meaningful. And I think reminded us of a period in our recent past when people in both parties probably felt better not only about each other, but about their own party.
Kelsey Snell, what did you notice?
You know, I noticed that while President Donald Trump is not in the room, there have been references to him then in almost every speech. And it's been quite remarkable. I actually thought it was really very moving when President Obama talked about, he said, what a better way to honor John McCain's life of public service than by recognizing that there are some things bigger than fame, power, principles that are eternal. This was a big theme of all of these speeches has been talking about moving forward in the footsteps of McCain and building a more bipartisan, a more grounded type of politics that has people in the room felt were lacking in the current atmosphere.
As President Obama said, he said that he and Senator McCain would get together in the Oval Office for conversations occasionally and would not withhold their political disagreements from each other. But he said at the end of the day, we always knew that we were on the same team. Another thing I noted, Ron and Kelsey, George W. Bush mentioned, and this is something that I've been blessed to observe as a reporter in war zones all over the years, political dissidents in Russia, in China, in Egypt, in Iraq, all over the world, were thrilled when they would hear that Senator John McCain knew about them and respected them. They seemed to think that as a man who had been in prison for 5.5 years himself, he understood their risk, he understood their sacrifice, in a way no other politician in the world did.
Yes, and he was an electric person to have in the room. Many times when senators travel around the world on these congressional delegations, they sit there, they say the diplomatic things, they ask a few questions, they listen. John McCain was a person who always was going to engage you, who was always going to have a lot to say, was going to tell you what he didn't like about your policy, and was going to defend the American point of view. This kind of engagement, I think, is always gratifying to leaders of other countries and challenging to them, and it's just something that they're likely to look forward to.
I guess it reminds us, too, Kelsey Snell, that John McCain was an image of America in the world, regardless of who was president.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of the things that he is most well known for outside of the U.S., is how frequently he traveled, how often he made sure that he was in the countries that he was working on. And anytime he was working on policy, he wanted to go see the situation on the ground. And I was out on the front lawn of the Capitol yesterday as people were lining up for to see him lying in state in the rotunda. And one of the things I noticed is there were people holding signs that said that I was a political dissident, or thank you for recognizing prisoners of war in my country. And he very much spoke to people in that way.
Kelsey Snell outside the National Cathedral, and Ron Elving, thanks very much for being with us. We have, of course, been covering services at the National Cathedral of Senator John McCain.